Hello and welcome to the June edition of the Institute of Astronomy's AstroPod. I'm Quinton Goddard.
And I'm Anna Quiter.
Welcome to the show. It's another crackerjack episode for you this month. What have we got, Anna?
Well, Quinton, this month, as every month, we're going to be telling you what's going on in the Cambridge sky at night. Also, Laura Churcher will be joining us with some interesting astro news. Keep an eye out for the Microsoft software that allows you to be an astronomer in your own home.
And later on in the show, I'll be talking to Luke Barnes, who's helping us understand just how big the universe is. You've probably heard about NASA's new probe, which has recently landed on the surface of Mars.
Yes, Quincy, I believe it's called the Phoenix Lander, and it just landed last week, and it's intending to work for the next 3 months on Mars.
It's got a giant robotic arm which is able to dig up soil samples from near where it's landed. It then cooks these in an oven and hopes to find the ingredients that might have been needed to support life at some stage in Mars's history.
Beyond the amazing technical advances needed to have such a giant laboratory landing on Mars, the way that it landed was also remarkable. This is the first probe since the 60s which was able to use retro rockets to land, and this sort of technology will be very important if we're ever going to put people on Mars.
The Phoenix Lander has already sent back pictures to Earth, and if you'd like more information on this, you can go to the Cargo Bay area of our website. So Anna, what's going on with the sky at night around Cambridge?
This month we have a pretty quiet month in the sky around Cambridge. The main thing to look for is the moon. Now I know that sounds pretty funny because the moon is always out there, but what you're going to do this month is use the moon to reference to different planets. So on Sunday, the 8th, Mars will be 1.1 degrees north of the moon. On Monday, the 9th, Saturn will be 3 degrees north of the moon. On Friday, the 20th, Jupiter will be 2 degrees north of the moon. On Monday, the 23rd, Neptune will be 0.8 degrees south. And Wednesday, the 25th, Uranus will be 4 degrees south of the moon. Just for your reference, the moon is about a half degree across, so you can use that to gauge the 1 degree, 2 degree, 3 degree measurements I just gave you. This month, we suggest that you pick your favorite constellation and look at it in detail with a home telescope or binoculars.
Thanks very much for that, Anna. Now here's Laura with the news.
Hi, I'm Laura Churcher, and welcome to this month's Astro News. Microsoft releases online observatory. Software giant Microsoft has recently released the highly anticipated Worldwide Telescope. The Worldwide Telescope is an online observatory that is freely available on the web and allows users to browse the entire night sky at a range of wavelengths and zoom in on celestial objects that have been studied extensively by astronomers worldwide. By using data from some of our most powerful telescopes such as Hubble, Chandra and Spitzer, the software allows you to explore the universe from your desktop, from solar system planets, asteroids and the lunar surface, out to some of the most distant objects in the universe. With introductory tours included, the software is user-friendly and easy to navigate, and opens up the world of professional astronomy to everyone. Dr. Roy Gould, a researcher at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, said users can see the X-ray view of the sky, zoom into bright radiation clouds, and then crossfade into the visible light view and discover the cloud remnants of a supernova explosion from 1,000 years ago. He believes this new creation from Microsoft will have a profound impact on the way we view the universe. To download the software, visit www.worldwidetelescope.org or check out the Cargo Bay area of our website for the links. Retuning the antennae galaxies. Using recent data from the Hubble Space Telescope, scientists have obtained our best measurement yet of the distance to a merging pair of galaxies, the antennae galaxies, named after their peculiar shape. Measuring accurate distances is a fundamental yet painfully difficult task in astronomy. Practically everything we can determine about a celestial object, such as how bright it is and how big it is, depends on knowing just how far away that object lies. One of the best ways to measure distance in astronomy is to use standard candles, which are objects such as Cepheid variables and red giants, whose luminosity are known and thus their change in brightness reveals how far away they are. By studying the red giants in an outer patch of the antenna system, the Hubble scientists determined the distance of the system to be 45 million light years. This is 20 million light years closer than previously thought, and reconciles the conflict between the standard theory of early merging events and the distance of the system. For this new measurement, astronomers had to invoke extreme physical characteristics of the system, such as high star formation rate, supermassive star clusters, and ultra-luminous X-ray sources. The Milky Way's latest supernova and another explosive find. Our final story reports on the explosive findings of two international teams of astronomers who work in the field of supernovae. Supernovae are explosions of massive stars that are ending their lives and on their way to becoming black holes or neutron stars. We expect to see a supernova in the Milky Way about once every 50 years, but the last known supernova was Kepler's supernova in the constellation of Ophiuchus, which occurred in 1604. So where have all the supernovae gone? The answer is that they are hiding behind the dust that fills our galaxy and blocks any visible light from these spectacular events. However, shifting our detectors to observe at radio wavelengths allows us to see the remnant of the explosion. Using the Very Large Array radio telescope in New Mexico and X-ray images from the Chandra satellite, scientists recently reported the discovery of a new remnant that is expanding in the wake of a supernova explosion right before our very eyes. The remnant has grown by about 15% since 1985, indicating that a supernova occurred there around 1900, adding evidence to our estimate of the rate of supernova explosions. Given that supernovae are infrequent, the odds of catching one just as it goes off are fairly slim. However, on the 9th of January 2008, while Alicia Soderberg and Ido Berger from the Princeton University were happily observing an old supernova remnant in another galaxy, NGC 2770, with the Swift X-ray telescope, an overwhelming X-ray blaze appeared in a different part of the galaxy. It brightened rapidly for 1 minute and then faded away over the next several minutes. In the following days, the X-ray blaze turned out to mark the site of a new, ordinary supernova swelling into view. This fantastic and very lucky discovery is a treat for X-ray astronomers, but they are after more, Soderberg says. The next generation of wide-field X-ray satellites will find hundreds of supernovae every year exactly when they explode. That's all for this month's news roundup. For more information about any of our news stories, visit the Cargo Bay area of our website at www.ast.cam.ac.uk/astropod/news.
Thanks, Laura, for those fascinating morsels of astronomy knowledge. Up next is Quincy, who's interviewing Luke Barnes, and Luke is going to help us visualize the size of the universe.
And now it's time for the interview section of our podcast. This month I'm speaking to Luke Barnes. Welcome to the show, Luke.
Oh, it's good to be here, Quentin.
Luke grew up in New South Wales, hence the interesting accent. He later on went to the University of Sydney, where he studied physics, before coming here to the Institute of Astronomy, where he's now a PhD student. He's also a keen cricketer and an expert seagull fisherman. So this month, Luke is going to be helping us try to visualise how big the universe is. Now, often in the show, when we talk about sizes and distances, we mention numbers such as 1 times 10 to the 20 metres. And these numbers are very hard to get your head round. So this month, we're going to try and get our head round just how big the universe is. So Luke, let's start off with a sort of nice, easy example and try and visualise just how big Mount Everest is, for example.
Right, so if the biggest thing on the surface of Earth is obviously Everest, and we'll go all the way from sea level. So imagine that you've got some excellent arts and crafts skills. Your paper mache skills are fantastic, as I'm sure they are.
My Blue Peter skills are pretty tip top. Yes.
Yeah, that's good. And you build a model of Everest, which is the size of a 2-story house. Right. So on that scale, you then construct a model of yourself, and you are about 1.5 millimeters high, so the thickness of a thick lead pencil or something, you know, about that size. So if you're trying to imagine this, imagine you know, you're that size, and then sort of shrink yourself up to full size, and then shrink the house up, and then that'll be the size of Everest. It's actually quite hard to do. Another way to think about it is, imagine if you're you and you're looking up at a huge tall building. I looked this up at Wikipedia. The source of all knowledge tells me that the tallest building in the UK is the Canary Wharf Tower, which is 240 meters high. So imagine you're looking up at that building, and then down from the heavens comes a giant 2-story house, and it sits next to that building, and the size of the building is the size of one step leading up to the patio of that huge 2-story house. So that house is then the same size as Mount Everest. And so there's Mount Everest, and there's the building, and then there's tiny little you looking down up at this whole thing from the street.
So I'm pretty small in comparison. And just before we go on, I'd like to say to any children listening out there, please do ask permission from your parents before you try and build a giant papier-mâché-sized Mount Everest.
Please send in a photo if you do achieve that goal.
So let's move on up from our example of Mount Everest to, say, the size of the Earth, which is a fairly big object compared to us.
Right. So once you've built Everest, you've obviously got some great skills working there. So build yourself a model of Earth, which is also the size of a two-story house. So a giant ball, two stories high, basically. You're going to want to paint it blue and green, obviously. Now, on that scale, we're going to build a model of Everest. So what you're going to use is a little spare bit of glue and mold it into a bump that's about half a centimeter high. Yep. And that will be our model of Mount Everest. You've now got to try and get back to where we were before. So you imagine that little blob of glue is then that huge two-story house where the first step was the big building and then you're on the street looking up at the building. It's actually quite difficult to do. If you've got this giant model of the Earth and you wanted to make a model of yourself, it would be rather difficult. What you'd have to do is get one of your hairs and split it lengthways into about 60 pieces and then use one of those, and that's about the right height for you.
Pretty damn tiny. And just again, another warning, if any kids are planning to build a giant model of the Earth, please don't do so on the top of a hill as it could roll down and injure people. So let's go up one scale further and move up from the Earth, which is pretty big, but obviously the Earth revolves around the Sun. So just how big is the Sun in comparison?
Well, if you took your model of the Earth and painted it yellow, you'd get a great big model Sun. So that's nice and easy. And then you've got to build yourself a model Earth. And in this case, a tennis ball will do it. So it's about 7 centimeters across. And if you wanted to do it to scale in terms of the distance, it'd be about 800 meters away from the Sun and, you know, revolving around it once a year.
So once again, you know, us on that scale is almost impossible to imagine. We're talking the size of atoms, right?
That's another story. How do you visualize the size of an atom? But yeah, obviously you're starting to lose grip on how things are. We've got to do this thing in stages.
So let's go up one stage further then and start talking about the solar system.
So the outermost planet is Neptune, as we all know. It's not Pluto anymore. So suppose you stuck Neptune's orbit in your average sort of 20 meter across backyard. So you built a model of the solar system on that scale. On that scale, the Sun is about the size of a handwritten O.
So
it's about 3 millimeters across.
So really, in the solar system, there's a lot of empty space as well, which I think is one of the things that people find quite hard to visualize.
There's a fantastic amount of empty space. I mean, there's even more empty space around us because on that scale of the backyard, the nearest star to the Sun, which is Proxima Centauri, is about 90 kilometers away on that scale.
So let's go up to an even bigger example and try and think about just how big our own galaxy is.
Well, this is where things get really tough. You've really got to go to quite ridiculous lengths to get a decent comparison here. But suppose you drew a model of the solar system on the palm of your hand. So the outer ring of the outer orbit of Neptune goes around on the palm of your hand. And you think that what you're going to do is, to get an idea of this, you're going to jog the same distance on that scale that it would be to get to the center of our galaxy. So not all the way across, just from where we are to the center. So how far would you have to jog? Well, I had to get on Google Earth to work this one out. An example would be if you started in Miami, Florida, and jogged to Alaska. That would be an example. With the solar system on the palm of your hand, you could go from Edinburgh to Athens and back to try and get an idea of how big our galaxy is compared to the solar system. If you want a slightly smaller example, if you suppose you had one of your hairs, an ordinary human hair, and look down on the end of that hair, the cross section, the smallest bit, and suppose you carefully now get a pen and draw the orbit of Neptune around on the end of your hair. On that scale, the galaxy, the size of the galaxy is about 20 kilometers across. So if you've got your head around that one, then you're doing a lot better than I am.
Yeah, it's getting tough to think about these kind of things now. So we really, our solar system is fairly insignificant in the galaxy. So let's go up, you know, a scale further and try and think about the Milky Way's place in the universe.
Well, again, it's kind of tough. We could think about how many stars there are in the Milky Way. We know the number, it's 100 billion, but we haven't really got a grasp on that number. Suppose if you had a piece of paper the size of a football field and you cut it up into pieces that were just big enough to put a full stop on, a period on, then that would be 100 billion pieces. Again, the imagination is getting stretched at this point. But if we want to go the next step up from galaxies, then we've really got to start looking at sort of clusters of galaxies and the universe as a whole. And we could use the example of the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, which was an image of the sky, of a tiny part of the sky taken by the Hubble Space Telescope. And it's quite hard to get your head around this one as well, but we'll give it a try. Suppose that you, again, your papier-mâché skills have excelled themselves, and you're making a planetarium, a huge dome, which is about 6 stories tall, so about 20 meters up, and this a huge hemisphere. You go on the inside of it, you paint all the inside black, and then you have the idea that you're going to paint onto the surface all the stars. So if you then get on your ladder and go up and find a little piece of sky which is the size of a postage stamp, that's the size of the sky that was pictured by the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. It's probably worthwhile at this stage going to the website, I'll make sure it gets put up there, and getting the actual picture itself. It's amazing to look at, because on this picture, there's about, if you get a computer to count it, there's a whole, it's just full of dots, and each of these dots is a single galaxy. So on that size of sky, you know, about the size of a postage stamp, you know, looking up at the sky 20 meters away, you can see about 10,000 galaxies. Now, each one of those galaxies is, if you remember, if we go back down the scale, is you know, Florida to Alaska is the size of a, you know, good luck to you. So the interesting thing is, if you were to fill in the whole, you suppose you wanted to paint that whole dome, that whole big black dome, on the scale that the Hubble Ultra Deep Field is painted, you would actually need to paint about 10 million of these little images on there. So if you can imagine, you've finished the whole thing, you're lying down on the ground, staring up at this huge hemisphere, and on each little postage stamp area, there are 10,000 galaxies. And then there's 10 million of those covering the whole sky. And then that's only half the sky. And then each galaxy is huge. And then, you know, the solar system is huge. The sun is huge. The Earth is huge. Everest is huge. And you're not.
I guess the problem is these kind of exercises is they can really make you feel kind of insignificant in light of how big the universe is. Well, Luke, I think you've given us all something to think about this month. Thanks for coming on the show.
Ah, thanks very much.
Thanks, Quincy. Now it's off to the astronomy grab bag, answering your questions.
And unfortunately this month, the curse of the STFC budget crisis strikes once more, and we've only got 2 questions for you. Our first question is, why do all the planets orbit in the same plane?
Well, Quincy, it turns out that all of the planets orbit in the same plane because they all form from the same disk, which formed around the Sun when the solar system came to be. What happened is, we think that the solar system formed from a spherical dust cloud. That dust cloud was spinning, and as the dust cloud collapsed under its own gravity, conservation of angular momentum meant that the dust cloud had to form into a disk. That's the same process that goes into forming disks in other structures in the universe, such as galaxies and the rings that we see around planets. Quincy, can you please tell us what a spectrum is and why they're useful in astronomy?
Well, to answer this question properly, let's think about our primary school science days. I'm sure you were all shown the experiment when you shine white light through a prism, and the other side emerges a rainbow running from blue to red. Well, in astronomy we do the same thing, but we look at the white light from a star. We put the white light through what we call a spectrograph, and this breaks down the star's light into its component colours or wavelengths. Now, to make a spectra, we then measure this, and we plot the wavelength of the light and how much light at each wavelength we get. And that's what we call a spectra. And when we do this for stars, we get a characteristic shape, but superimposed on top of this are peaks or troughs in this spectra. And this tells us information about the elements contained within the stars, as certain elements will absorb or emit light at very specific wavelengths. Now we can do the same for galaxies and measure their spectra. And when we look at that, we can see shifts in certain peaks and troughs, and that tells us about how far away the galaxy is from us. We can also do the same for quasars. Now quasars are very distant objects, and as the light from the quasar travels to us, it passes through a lot of intervening gas and dust. So the spectra reveals information about that intervening gas and dust. Now it's time for the part of the show that afterwards you'll really wish you could unlisten to. That's right, it's the astronomy joke of the month.
Hi, Michelle.
Hey, Jane.
Do you have another joke for me?
I do. It's not great.
Well, let's hear it anyway.
Okay. Drum roll, please. What do you call an overweight alien?
I don't know, Michelle. What do you call an overweight alien?
An extra cholesterol. Genuinely the worst joke ever.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm truly sorry for that joke. I can assure you in future months we will be thinking about removing the Astronomy Joke of the Month from the AstroPod. Well, that's about all we've got time for you on the show this month. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.